Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by the Van Halen comeback. This makes me want to jump off a fucking bridge. Or wait, it makes me want to move to Panama, but then still jump off a bridge. And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex. To the left of me is James.
Breathing.
Yeah. Just had a... He just balked on a sneeze.
And Dr. Pepper's here, too.
Yeah, he is. We're not sponsored by Dr. Pepper. We're just drinking... Well, one of us is drinking Dr. Pepper.
It's me. And Valerie Plame's here.
I don't know who that is.
You don't?
No.
Okay, well, she's not really here.
Okay.
Does that name ring a bell, though?
No.
Okay.
Remember that time when I said I don't know who that is?
No, I know, but it might ring a bell. But apparently it doesn't.
No.
Anyway, Valerie Plame was a CIA operative.
Oh, okay. This is like a couple years ago or something?
Yeah. In real life.
Yeah. I only know it in movies, and the Doug Liman movie Fair Game is based on
okay. it. Okay. Yeah. I was going to say, unless it happened in a movie, you probably don't know it. But luckily Mr. Liman came along.
Sean Penn, Naomi Watts.
Yeah, no, I read about that. Mm. Anyway, so what's who's Valerie Plame then, if you kind of know?
She was a non-official cover agent.
That's right.
Is that right? I don't know. I don't remember the story any more than that.
Well, yeah, she was a CIA operative, and someone blew her cover, and a lot of politicians in power during George W. Bush's administration took a lot of heat over it, because you're not supposed to out active CIA people.
Well, yeah, that's sort of what I've been told in movies
yeah.
and stuff.
Yeah, they were right. But you said what I was trying to get to, non-official cover.
Yeah. One might even shorten it to knock.
They might.
Yeah.
Including the people who wrote the series of films we're going to be talking about today.
Yep, that's right.
Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
What does non-official cover mean?
It's sort of... these people are spies, but even it's sort of like outside of the government, like the government that they're working for doesn't necessarily know that they're where they are or something. Is that right?
Yeah, maybe not necessarily. Well, yeah, sometimes certain branches of government won't know where they are, but it's kind of like if they get they're working for the government, you know, they really are. But on paper and all their, you know, all the paperwork would say that they're not government employees.
Mm-hmm.
So often they're working just as you know, just, you know, having any normal job that anybody else would have in a country, but they're also performing espionage while they're there.
Oh, yes.
Is that what you do to espionage? Perform?
Sure.
Commit? I don't know.
Nobody is going to call us on it, no. So.
No one calls us on anything because they don't listen.
Exactly. Ethan Hunt is not a subscriber, nor is anyone.
But yeah, basically, if you're a non-official cover agent, if you get caught, the government basically denies that you're working for them because you're not really working for them,
mm-hmm.
even though you are, but officially you're not.
Yeah.
Non-official cover. And that is kind of what Mission Impossible is all about.
Yeah.
At least once in a while.
Yeah.
or the knock list plays a central part to the first one, especially.
Yeah, definitely.
It's, I mean, the most famous thing of the series, maybe not anymore, but for the longest time was Ethan luring down to that room.
Yeah, I think that's still the most iconic moment in the series, for sure.
Image-wise, for sure, that would be it. And he was in the CIA office down stealing the knock list, which means he would have the real people's names and their cover names so you could figure out who's, you know, working non-official cover, which is the whole point is to avoid that.
Yeah, and the idea is if that list gets in the wrong people's hands, a lot of spies will get killed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you could sell that to people or go kill them yourself or what have you. It would give you a lot of power. So yeah, let's start with number one. One through all of them really quickly and then kind of how we feel about the whole series.
Yeah. Number one is awesome. I like number one.
Yeah, 1996.
Yeah.
BDP.
directed by Brian De Palma.
Most people call him BDP.
No, not a lot of people do that.
Do you like Brian De Palma?
No, not really. He's made movies that I like, but I mean, Scarface, it's like There Will Be Blood. If you put anybody but Daniel Day-Lewis playing Daniel Plainview, that movie's a lot more boring, and it's the same with Al Pacino and Scarface. Like, that's just a performance that is just so entertaining. It doesn't matter what's happening around them.
Yeah.
I'd watch that movie if that performance wasn't driving Miss Daisy, you know? Yeah. Like,
but yeah, Brian De Palma's kind of all over the place. He's done action before, yep. And this was action, but he kind of got a start in horror. Like, he's kind of...
He did Carrie, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And because of the body double and a couple other 80s horror things. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's he's kind of all over the place, but he took on this one. Obviously, Mission Impossible, the film, came from the TV show.
Yes.
By the same name.
Yes. 60s TV show created by Bruce Geller, I believe.
Yeah. And people really liked that.
Sure.
They did. Yeah. It's true.
I think I remember my dad saying he enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, I asked my dad if he used to watch it. He's like, oh yeah, everybody watched it. That was just a
just
big
a thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that came out in 1996.
Yes.
Did well. People dug it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I think that movie was generally considered disappointing. Like, it made a lot of money. A lot of people went to see it. But I think the general consensus on that movie was that it was a letdown. And I found that in conversations with that movie for like a decade.
Yeah. And the big problem I think most people had.
Overly complicated or maybe not really telling people what's going on.
Yeah.
Because I think there are certainly points in that movie where... It gets confusing. I'm not confused by it, but I've seen it so many
times.
Yeah,
exactly.
So I don't know how confused I was initially, but I assume I didn't piece it together the first time I saw it.
Yeah, and we probably first saw it in 1996 or 7 when we probably weren't the best at keeping up with complicated adult
movies.
Just
like, helicopter! Yeah!
Right now, I think on Rotten Tomatoes, it's got like a 59 or a 60%, which is not great.
Nope.
It's interesting because that one gets, as I said... 50 or 60 something, and then 2 and 3 also get in the 60s, and then Ghost Protocol number 4 is like 97 or 93 or something ridiculous.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Yeah, we'll stick to number 1 for now.
Yeah. I like it. As I was rewatching it, because I hadn't seen it in a long time except for parts of it on TV a few years ago, I was getting kind of worried at the beginning. I was like, ooh, this is really 90s. Like, there are a lot of dissolves going on, and that makes me uncomfortable. But once you get out of that first, basically once Emilio Estevez dies, that movie gets pretty sweet. And I don't mean that as a dig at Emilio.
No,
I think
we're both Emilio fans.
Yeah, well, calling me an Emilio fan is a bit of a stretch.
Emilio?
Yeah, he dipped his hat like so. But yeah, like it sort of. It's a cool movie, and there's the scene with Kittredge in the restaurant. That's awesome. The finale's really cool. All the stuff in Langley's awesome. Jean Reno's there. Kristen Scott Thomas looking like an extremely pretty Sarah Vowell. It's true, though.
It's funny to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's good. And I like the cinematography. I think it's a really, like, classical type movie. It looks really classical. There's a lot of Hitchcock influence in it, which I enjoy.
Well, yeah, you said classical there, and that was one thing I was going to get to. It is very, in a lot of ways, very classic spy movie.
Yeah, yeah,
you
absolutely.
You know, it's kind of, you know, old Europe set, which is a lot of kind of the old spy movies were. A bit of globetrotting, but trains and disguises and people in love and deception. And
yeah.
It really hits a lot of just the old beats. And I mean, that's nothing new, but... For, you know, when it came out to try to take all these things, take a 60s TV show, there aren't really that many spy movies. You know, it is definitely a genre, subgenre, but to try to update that, I think they did a good job of keeping it kind of old and classic, but entertaining enough.
I agree. And if you look at the time, it's 1996. I think GoldenEye was 95. But before then, the last Bond movie was... like 1988 or something, the last Timothy Dalton one. So, like, there had been a drought in, you know, spy movies.
Yeah.
The biggest spy movie franchise. I'm sure there was something. You
yeah.
know? Like, there was the Point of No Return in 1993, but...
yeah, you know. But that's what I mean. There was kind of a gap, and it really seemed like they took it on themselves to, you know, to bring it back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, I probably should just mention I've never seen any of the show, so...
yeah, no, neither of us have.
Okay. Yeah. And yeah, you mentioned Kittredge. Which
yes.
is, who's that in this movie?
Kittredge is basically Ethan Hunt's boss. Ethan Hunt played by Tom Cruise. Kittredge is played by Henry Czerny. It's like Czerny, yeah. Canadian actor who you've seen in a ton of Canadian productions that you don't remember the names of. And God, he's amazing in this movie. He is so awesome. Just like his low talking in that restaurant scene is so good.
Yeah, and, well, you know who he reminded me of? And then I looked around on the internet to see if anybody else saw this in him as well. Agent Smith.
Yeah, yeah.
It gives me a total Agent Smith vibe. And obviously, yeah. I couldn't have known that the first time watching it, but it's just kind of Agent Smith without the glasses and slightly less cool voice, but still a cool voice.
I still got his way of speaking is so awesome. And it's just quietly douchey and it's beautiful.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the diner scene a little bit?
Yeah, like the one with the fish tanks?
Yeah, stuff? With yeah, Kit Ridge.
It's, yeah, it's that's a really high-class diner, if that's a diner, but I think it's more of a restaurant.
Okay, a bistro.
Yeah, after basically Ethan's whole team is killed in the
They're dead. My team is dead.
They're all dead. And yeah, they're all killed in Prague. Ethan calls Kittredge and yells into the phone inconspicuously, given that it's a public phone, and meets up with him at a restaurant. And Kittredge is giving him like a visa and stuff and to get him out of the country so he can go into hiding. But Ethan sort of realizes that the operation was sort of a mole hunt. And now they think like, you know, someone in the agency that's working for somebody else, like, and Kittredge and IMF, I guess, that he works for, right?
Yeah.
Think that Ethan is the mole. And this really cool thing happens when Ethan starts to figure this out. The camera in that scene, basically, that's when you get a lot of low-angle tilted shots. Like, sort of, there's a lot of tilted cameras in this movie, which I love. That's the thing about the cinematography. I think it's awesome in this movie. But it sort of always represents sort of a confusion that Ethan is feeling.
Yeah.
And I think in that scene in particular, it looks amazing. And there's a fish tank in the roof over top of Kittredge's head, which is awesome.
Yeah.
And it's just this really menacing scene. And Ethan eventually gets out with this piece of like red and green gum that's explosive. He throws it against a fish tank.
Pasta lasagna, don't get any on ya.
Exactly. And makes a fish tank explode. The front window of the restaurant blows out and Ethan runs away.
Yeah.
And it's sweet.
Yeah. And now it's on. He's kind of gone rogue now. Yeah. He's kind of, you know, his whole team died, as we've said, and he says quite comically loudly. And yeah, now it's Ethan on his own because IMF basically sacrificed his whole team.
Yeah, exactly.
Intentionally. Yeah. Then we still have Claire, though. Claire is one person who's part of this mission who doesn't die.
Yep.
And Claire is Jim Phelps, a.k.a. John Voight's wife of 25 years. His junior, it seems, but we'll roll with this. It's kind of those two on their own now. At first, Ethan doesn't really trust her because, you know, she made it out alive, but they end up kind of
working together. One thing I really like about this movie, I love that you see Ethan deliriously tired. Because that's something you don't see in movies.
Yeah.
Clearly, that character is super tired when Claire is coming back into the apartment or the wherever the crow's nest, whatever you want to call it. And yeah, you don't see spies in spy movies being super tired like that. It's sort of like in the Miami Vice movie when Colin Farrell picks up his phone and says hello. You know, like you never see that. Yeah. But it's just like that's how things would be. And I enjoy that. But anyways, moving on.
Yeah, no, but this was kind of one thing people liked about this, and I think maybe not so much about the rest of the series, but number one in particular really was kind of a realistic spy movie. You know,
Ish.
I mean, it's still a Hollywood action film. Yeah. You're going to have that. But, you know, I think for a lot of it up until
the finale,
the ending, it is a lot quieter, more like disguising and chasing and fooling people than it is.
I agree.
Running explosions.
Yep.
Outside of the diner. How do you feel about Claire and Ethan? They kind of, like, throughout the movie, they're on a team. There seems to be some sexual or romantic stuff between them, but it's never really made explicit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big part of the spy genre is, you know, the girl.
Yeah.
There's usually an evil girl and a good girl. And this one, our good girl should be Claire. And when you watch it now, you just expect them to, you know, have some kiss and then they're together and they trust each other, blah, blah, blah. And you never really get that physical consummation of
You get sort
friendship.
Of like a hint of it maybe happening in that. I mean, Ethan never makes a move on her because she's his friend's wife, you know, his mentor's wife. But she sort of, you know, goes for it a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think there's an implication that it's possible that something would happen.
Yeah, well, my understanding is that it was in the script and they just cut the scenes where it happens because the movie was already running long.
Okay, fair enough.
It just seems like a weird thing to cut.
yeah, But if you had to cut something in this movie, I'd rather it be that than...
Yeah, anything else.
Yeah. Because yeah. It is a pretty tight movie. Like, there's not a lot to cut.
Yeah. Other than that. Well, yeah, so speaking of Claire and her husband there, Jim Phelps.
Yep.
John Voight.
Yep.
Jim Phelps was the main character from the TV show.
Yes.
And so I guess a lot of people were kind of upset that, you know, right near the start of the movie, he gets killed off. So a lot yes. of people, you know, were upset that they came to see this franchise that, you know, with this character, and all of a sudden, he's dead.
Again, sort of going with the Hitchcockian vibe of some of the elements of this movie.
Yeah, someone who you expect to be around till the end dying. Like
same with Emilio. Emilio, yeah. at the time, was a bigger star than that character.
Yeah, exactly. To be in it for the first 12 minutes and then never be heard from again. Spoilers, you do hear from Jim Phelps again.
Yes.
He doesn't actually die. And again, this kind of upset people because... Either now the guy that you really like and came to see is evil.
Yeah. And, which is cool.
Yeah. Again, kind of a Hitchcockian total curveball.
Yeah. Yeah.
yeah.
And I mean, a big part of that when I was thinking about people being pissed about Phelps being the villain is that we weren't totally used to remakes yet. Like, or, you know, adaptations into film where things just get readjusted, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's a big, that wouldn't happen anymore. That wouldn't be a big deal for people going to see the movies because, you know, it's more, you see adaptations changing things up a lot more now.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess there were some people involved with the TV show when this movie started coming together and then they kind of saw what happened to Jim Phelps and...
Well, the guy that played Jim Phelps in the movie was offered the role of Jim Phelps.
Yeah.
Or sorry, in the TV show was offered the role of Jim Phelps, which is crazy.
Yeah. But then kind of what happened to him, they didn't like. And then he told kind of some other people who were going to act as consultants or other smaller roles in the film.
Mm-hmm.
He said, don't do it. Don't even get involved with these people, which is a bit of a shame.
Yeah.
But whatever.
Yeah.
I guess we should get to the Langley scene.
Yeah, we should talk about the Langley scene.
The CIA scene. So this is, again, as we discussed, probably the most iconic part of the whole series still. And this is the famous scene where they break into CIA headquarters to get the aforementioned knock list.
Yes.
And it's Jean Reno.
Yeah.
Or Jean Reno to our American listeners. And they sneak into CIA headquarters through the air ducts. And lower him into that room with, you know, it's that one guy's office, single computer, that all white room that you can probably remember.
High security. There's like a noise alarm, temperature alarm, and a scent, like, sorry, you know, if you touch anything.
Yeah.
That kind of alarm.
Yeah.
I'm not up on my English.
No. So we get lowered in through the air ducts. He messes with the beam. Some help from Ving Rhames, too.
Yeah, yeah. Playing Luther Stickle.
It's a weird name.
Luther's a sweet name.
Yeah.
I think that works for Ving Rhames.
Stickle doesn't do it for you, though.
That's just weird. It's just weird.
Yeah. And they're successful in getting the knock list, and they leave, but not without being undetected.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's the really badass knife falling at the very end and just landing right on the corner of the desk.
Yeah.
Which is just, like, I mean, I don't even think we need to talk about this scene. It's just awesome. And yeah, everybody knows what we're talking about.
Yeah, and it's just...
We have nothing new to say about it.
No, it's just one of those set pieces where I'm sure very early on they knew that this was going to be in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably, you know, 15 minutes with all the cutting from the guy running to the bathroom and puking and stuff. But yeah, just a very, very cool scene. And... kind of like we've said about number one, it's not a bunch of explosions. It's a very quiet scene.
Yeah.
You can't even say toast.
No, exactly.
And, toast, the loudest word in the English language.
Yeah. And whenever I do audio editing, whenever I edit this podcast, whenever our audio peaks, I think toast.
And the red bars.
Yeah. And audio people that listen to our podcast know that we peak a lot. There's a lot of toast on this podcast. But yeah, I don't know. It seemed clearly made an impression on me.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that was kind of more one of the quieter, more, you know, thoughtful scenes in a way. And then, you know, we've said that that's kind of how this whole movie is. I mean, there is action, but it's more about following the plot and who's who and who's doing what and who's on whose side. And then we get to the climax.
Yes!
Again, awesome.
Oh, so awesome.
But in a slightly different... a bit more bombastic way.
Yeah. By this point, Ethan has figured out that Jim Phelps is villainous. Like, Phelps reintroduced himself as alive to Ethan earlier, when Ethan was trying to make sure that Kittredge would be on this train, where he's trying, basically the ending, he's trying to get all of the people that, you know, he's been in contact with, he's trying to get them all in one place so that Kittredge can recover the knock list, arrest Max, and he can out Phelps as well, or out Job, who it turns out to be Phelps. Yeah, so all these people end up on the train, and it works out that Phelps is sort of has to run away. By the way, in a scene that is totally badass towards the back of the train, when Phelps is like, you're the only person that's seen me alive, Ethan. And Ethan pulls out the glasses that have been used earlier with the camera on them and puts them on and is like, I'm not the only person that's seen you. I totally forgot that happened. And I got so excited as it was happening. I was just like, oh, you're getting so got, Phelps. Like,
yeah. And kind of in tone of this movie, too. It's not a big, you know, he comes swinging through the window and this, like, it's a very slow movement and just reveals everything. And it's way more about information and than like, it is about some crazy physical struggle.
It's like, why is he putting on glasses? Oh my god, the camera glasses. Oh my god! Owned! And then Kittredge is looking at a watch that these glasses are transmitting to because Hunt sent him this watch. And you see Kittredge seeing Phelps and it's just like, fucking yes.
Very exciting.
Oh, the best. And then Phelps sort of tries to get away and Jean Reno playing Krieger is... has got a helicopter behind the train and is going to pick up Phelps eventually, basically.
Yeah, Phelps is going to steal everything and hop up into the helicopter and ride off into the sunset and everything's good. Not so much.
Yeah, there's a train. There's a bit of a chase. Hunt follows Phelps onto the top of the train. The wind makes his hair look like Jim Carrey in Dumb and Dumber. and there's sort of a chase and... they end up, Phelps isn't able to get on the helicopter before the train has to go in the tunnel. So the helicopter follows into the tunnel. Phelps and Hunt both end up on the helicopter.
There's a speeding train through this small tunnel and a helicopter chasing
it. I know. It's pretty bonkers.
And I love Ethan's, when he's catching up to Phelps on the top and he just uses the wind, like jumps up and then just goes like two cars over it's and sweet. Holds on again.
and then we find out that, Ethan didn't just have a stick of gum. He had a pack. And he does the red light, green light thing again, sticks it to the elevator or the helicopter, and then jumps away from the helicopter and uses the helicopter explosion to blow him back onto the train where he catches it, which will never, ever happen ever to anybody.
Yep.
But goddamn, it's badass.
Yeah.
Like, it's sweet.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much the end of the movie. There's a quick little epilogue. Like, Claire dies. Nobody cares.
Nobody does care. She's foxy, though.
Oh, yeah. She's a babe.
Yeah, I totally forgot this.
Yeah, no. Oh, such a babe. And and then Ethan meets up with Luther. They have a drink. We find out Luther is working for IMF again. He had been disavowed, whatever. I wonder if we'll see him again. And and the movie ends. Ethan says he's done doing impossible missions and gets on an airplane. But what happens on the airplane?
Nothing.
He gets suggested the Cinema of the Caribbean, which is a mission, should he choose to accept it, which is another sweet scene that got me really excited again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like all the, again, we've talked about Bourne and everything. I do love these spy movies a lot.
Yeah.
Like, I love kind of the globetrotting stuff. I love all the little secret gadgets and stuff like that. And... yeah, I love just the small characters who are in on it that you just never hear from or see again.
Yeah.
Like, just these... they hire someone to be a stewardess for a flight, like, across the world to do one thing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah,
it's so exciting.
Yeah,
I love
awesome.
It. I have a negative review here.
Okay, cool.
Of the first Mission Impossible. Yeah.
This movie was not without its negative reviews.
No, absolutely.
Actually, I remember... I have a memory. I still lived in Ottawa when this movie came out. Ottawa has this busker festival, and I remember...
I've been there.
Yeah, it's sweet.
It is.
There was a juggler or something at this busker festival, and I guess it must have been 1996, because he was like, now you get to watch my act, and then you get to throw in as much money as you feel I deserved. You know, but it's totally different than if you go for the movies, and you have to pay for that Mission Impossible movie before finding out it sucks. And that totally happened. My family was there, and I thought that was funny, and... yeah, that's how people felt about Mission Impossible in 1996.
Okay. So here is how Hal Hinson feels.
Oh, okay.
Movie critic for the Washington Post.
Mm.
his review at the time was, "There are empty thrills and some suspense, but throughout the film we keep waiting for some trace of personality, some color in the dialogue, some hipness in the staging or in the character's attitude, and it's not there."
Okay.
You think that's fair?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, there's not a lot of character.
No, there's really not. And, I mean, we'll talk about this again with the other ones, but...
Yeah.
You have Ethan as a character, and he's pretty much a blank slate. I mean, yeah. I guess that's kind of the point of these people who take on different personalities throughout a movie, that they're a blank canvas and can become whoever they want to be, but there's really not much, like, what do you know, what's Ethan like?
No, I don't know.
Awesome.
Spy-y.
Fast. He runs quickly.
He's got a wonderful smile.
Yeah, sure does. Yeah. Well, there's one thing I can tell you about Ethan, at least in the first Mission Impossible, he never fires a gun.
Yeah, which is cool.
Yes. It reminds me of... Jason Bourne
never smiling.
Never smiles. And it also reminds me of a line from The Rundown, which we've been discussing. Mm-hmm. The Rock in that movie is not a big fan of firing guns either.
Yeah, until the finale when he sort of has to.
Yeah, fires a lot of them. Yeah. But there's a line in that one that says, I forget who it was, but one of the bad guys in The Rundown says, "I've never met an American who doesn't like guns."
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there's something it's trying to be... Like, a comment about America getting away from these guns like that? Do you think that there's something to, like, maybe not, I'm not saying a big political statement or anything, but just to switch up the normal action star of a Hollywood movie, and it's, you know?
I think it's plausible that the idea in producing the movie was, let's make Ethan Hunt not sort of this, you know, super jacked killing machine. And again, Schwarzenegger, Stallone, their heyday had passed, and it's just sort of, I think... It was a reflection of what was going on at the time, for sure.
Yeah, and just being more of a smarter, sneakier.
Yeah, and also just sort of a spy. Brian.
Yeah.
A spy. Like, he's supposed to not be seen.
Yeah. Yeah. But even, I mean, so many spy movies, even the old ones, you know, just a silencer or like a little pistol or something, whereas, you know, Ethan doesn't get to that at all.
Yep.
Any other favorite things about Mission Impossible 1 that you want to mention?
The theme? Should we talk about the theme?
I guess we should at some point.
Yeah. There's a theme done by the two people in U2 that nobody cares about, Adam Clayton and Larry Mullen, which was on the charts. Like, it made pop music charts that year. And
I'd like to point out that all of the members of U2 are the ones that I don't care about.
Yeah, well,
In general, yes.
You know, yeah. I always found it funny that an instrumental song, like, the new version of the Mission Impossible theme was on pop music charts, and... It's decent, you know. I'm sure in 1996, I remember liking it in 1996.
Well, that's the thing. It's such an iconic song. I mean, even before this movie came out, I think I would have been able to tell you what song that was.
I don't know that I would have.
Really? I think I would have. Yeah. Like, it's just one of those songs, even from the TV show, it's so catchy, and I think it gives everybody that, because it was associated with that show, it gives everyone that feeling of, you know, sneaking around or spying or something. So it just gets used so often, or... Very close rip-offs of it get used so often in TV and movies.
Yeah, I guess I was just 10 by the time this movie was made, so I mean, I don't know. I don't know that I've ever heard the actual TV version.
All right, 4 years later?
Yeah. Wait, did they make a sequel to this? Wow.
Mission Impossible 2.
Yes.
I guess the first mission wasn't completely impossible, because here we are at the second one.
Yeah.
Ethan's still alive.
Yes.
He's on vacation.
He's rock climbing.
To terrible rock climbing music.
Oh, God.
I hate that first song. It's so bad, and it's such a bad fit for what's happening.
Is it the last song in this movie that you hate?
No.
You know, this movie also commissioned songs from Limp Bizkit and Metallica.
I know. That was on the boards on IMDb for this, and someone said Fred Durst and Wes Borland are the Paul McCartney and John Lennon of my generation. I thought that was really funny.
That is funny.
Anyway, he's climbing because he's on vacation.
Yeah.
But it's IMF. You can never get away.
Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band turns into chocolate starfish in the hot dog flavored water.
You can find a similar joke that I made on that board.
Okay, really good. Want. Good. So sorry, I cut you off because I love talking about Limp Bizkit.
He's climbing. They show up.
A guy in a helicopter shows up, points
suit.
At Ethan as if, like, he's pointing.
That's the guy.
Yeah, as if there's anybody else that he's going to shoot this rocket of a mission at him.
I know. I love the information rocket so much.
And with the zoom on it.
With sunglasses in it.
And then he puts on the sunglasses and he gets his mission. And the camera is rotating around him, but Ethan is also rotating himself. Have you noticed this?
No.
He's totally rotating. It's so amazing. Like, the camera's going to the right, and Ethan is slightly turning to the left the whole time.
That's weird.
It's so weird.
Okay. And he gets a new mission.
Yep.
Should he chooses to accept it, actually. He's got some IMF people to meet up with, but he also has to meet up with Naya.
Yeah.
A new civilian thief.
Yeah.
Tandy Newton.
Yes.
Two things I noticed about Tandy Newton in this movie.
What?
One, she has a weird voice.
Okay. Yep.
Two,
she was in Norbit. Is that number two?
Oh.
Okay.
Two, is there something wrong with her boobs?
Okay.
And that is that they're not in my face all the time. Their only flaw that I could see in the entire film.
Fair enough.
Anyway, moving on.
Yeah.
There's a problem.
Yes.
And it's called Chimera.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So, it's a disease and...
What happened? What's Chimera all about?
Chimera is really the terrible disease. If you get it in you after 20 hours, basically you're going to die. And you're going to die in a very unhappy manner. And...
Yeah. You don't die in 20 hours, but 20 hours is kind of the point of no return.
Yeah. You can be cured within 20 hours. And the idea is this virus, the villain played by Douglas Scott, wants to get a hold of this virus so that he can sell it to pharmaceutical companies that can release it and then make a shit ton of money selling the cure.
Yeah. Well, part of Chimera is that it's two parts. It's the disease and the cure. And he has both.
Yeah.
And so, that's great. You release this disease into the world. You already know everything about this disease and you've already made a cure.
Mm-hmm.
Sell the cure. Make a ton of money.
Yep.
Because you're an evil dude.
Yeah.
What was his name? Doug Ray?
Doug Ray Scott.
I thought he was awful in this.
Yeah, he's not very good.
I thought he was just really, really bad.
Awesome piece of trivia. Since this movie's schedule ran over budget, went way too long, he was originally cast as Wolverine.
I know.
And he couldn't do Wolverine because of this movie.
That's great.
Which is hilarious.
Yeah. Hugh Jackman's awesome.
Yeah, no, I know. Hugh Jackman's career thanks John Woo for running over schedule.
Yeah, that should be mentioned. Director of this one, Brian De Palma, BDP, moved on to bigger, better things.
No, he didn't.
And John
moved on to Femme Fatale.
And this was John Woo's one of his really big, like, American blockbusters.
His biggest American blockbuster. Because, he came with, he did a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie. It wasn't the one with the Pittsburgh Penguins game. Hard Target.
Okay.
That was his first American movie after doing The Killer and Hard Boiled, which are famous for their awesome / ridiculous action in Hong Kong with Chow Yun-Fat. Then he did Broken Arrow and then Face Off, which is bigger, and what led into this, which is Mission Impossible 2. This movie's really ridiculous.
Yeah, well, let's stick on John Woo and Hong Kong Fu for a little bit.
Yeah.
This is 2000.
Yeah.
This movie comes out.
Yes.
We had The Matrix the year before.
Mm-hmm.
Some Kung Fu wire fighting.
Yeah, and we should point out, John Woo is not known for, like, hand-to-hand combat. He's a gunfight guy.
Okay, yeah. And dove fight.
You said Kung Fu, and I just want to point out that. Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, and we also had... Matrix before this, Kill Bill a little bit after this, a few years after this.
Yeah, and it was like 2004.
2003, I think.
Okay.
And Crouching Tiger.
Yep.
But within a couple of years here, a few years, we do have kind of an Asian influence
and
on action.
This is when Jackie Chan was at his highest point in Hollywood. Rush Hour is 1998.
Right.
And, he had a couple of years where he was a thing.
Yeah. So I just wanted to point out this is kind of in that window. I mean, this window isn't absolutely closed or anything.
Yeah.
But
speaking of the year 2000, this might be the most year 2000 movie ever made, with Metallica, Limp Bizkit on the soundtrack, those sunglasses that Tom Cruise is wearing, Tom Cruise's hair, the fact that everybody in this movie is so orange. Like, there is so much spray tan going on in this movie. Have you Anthony Hopkins? His face, he looks like Snooki. It's absurd.
I know. If you're going to mention Anthony Hopkins, I'm going to mention the line.
Oh, and Hans Zimmer's Lisa Gerard phase is still going on.
Right, that's true. So it's clearly 2000.
Yeah.
Get some gladiator love in there. Yeah, Anthony Hopkins gets to say, this isn't Mission Difficult, Mr. Hunt, it's Mission Impossible. Yeah. Which is great. How did that not make it in the first movie?
I don't know.
Because
they were trying in the first movie.
But yeah, as you said, it is over the top, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
More action in this one than the first one.
Yes, and a different kind of action.
Yeah, we had chase scenes and stuff in the first one.
Now we're getting, like, gunfights and wheelie fights.
Motorcycle fights, wheelie fights.
Let's just talk about the things in this movie that are ridiculous. The chair,
let's talk about Tom Cruise's 2000 hair.
Yeah, which is sweet.
It looks so funny. Here's what I think. Especially in slow-mo.
Yeah, no, exactly. Here's my take on Mission Impossible 2. Because we know Tom Cruise has a big producerial hand in these movies. Tom Cruise was 39 in the year 2000. Mission Impossible 2 is Tom Cruise's midlife crisis.
Oh, is that what that
That's
is?
That's exactly what
That's
it is.
That's how this works?
Yep. It's his midlife crisis. He's trying to do all these things that the kids think are cool.
Yeah, I'm going to grow my hair out.
Grow my hair out. Limp Bizkit. Spray tan. Oakley sunglasses. John Woo. That's a thing that the kids like. He's new. He's hip. He's, you know. Yep. And, yeah, man, this movie is just, like, it's so 2000 to me, and it's also so, yeah, it's Tom Cruise's midlife crisis, because who else can have a midlife crisis on celluloid, you know?
Yeah, that was a good assessment.
Yeah, I think it's 100% accurate.
Yeah, no, I hadn't even considered it, but yeah, absolutely. I want to get to the motorcycles, but yeah, I want to mention one more thing before the motorcycles, okay. Just on Tom Cruise, being the man.
Okay.
I was totally late to the liking Tom Cruise thing.
Yeah.
And I'm an unabashed fan now.
Okay, that's fine. I think he's bad in the first movie. I think he's mediocre in the second.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. But yeah, as you said, he has a big hand in all this.
Yeah.
And I want to mention, do you know the thing about the stunt with the knife when he almost gets stabbed
yeah,
in the eye?
Yeah, I've seen a behind-the-scenes thing on that where yeah. there was like a string attached to the handle of the knife to keep, and it was attached to like a stick
yeah.
To keep it from actually hitting Tom Cruise's eye. But Tom Cruise really wanted that knife to get within a quarter inch of his eye, and that's really his eye. That's really a knife.
Yeah, really a knife. Yeah. And yeah, so he wanted to make it look real, so Doug Ray really comes down on it with, you know, all the speed. I mean, there is safety measures in place, obviously, but still, that's pretty ballsy.
Earlier take, the safety measures failed, though.
Yeah.
And he sort of just got out of the way just in time from what I remember. I haven't seen this since, like, 2002, but that's how I remember it.
And that's not like, your ankle's broken, let's delay shooting by two weeks. Like, you die.
Basically.
You get stabbed in the brain and you die.
You have to get really lucky to not die from that.
Yeah, at least your eye is just mangled, and that's best case scenario.
Yeah. Okay. He's playing the man in the iron mask for the rest of his life.
I like that movie. Anyway, motorcycles.
Yeah.
Vroom, vroom.
Yeah, we should talk about the weird car scene first, like early on.
Okay.
Tom Cruise and Tandy Newton have the sort of like car dance, which is just absurd. I just want to mention it. We don't even need to talk about it.
Nearly suicidal foreplay that they take.
And it's so weird. Like, it's just like they meet and then, you know,
second time they've seen each other.
They bang and then they have this car chase or something. Or wait, the banging is after the car chase, but then they're suddenly in love and that sets up the movie. Like, Tom Cruise automatically cares so much about her.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that again because that is a reoccurring thing.
Yeah, fair enough.
Tom Cruise and the ladies in this one.
The ending sequence is pretty insane. It Tom Cruise attacks basically a compound towards the end. The climax is him attacking a compound trying to get Chimera. At one point, he's on a motorcycle and sort of like does a front wheelie and does a spin and shoots out the gas tank of a car and makes it explode.
Which doesn't make, like, that's not a real thing.
No. Nope.
It's a real movie thing.
Yeah.
But, the looking in the rearview mirror and just shooting behind him.
Yeah.
So well.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
I like that a lot too.
And then to set up the final fight between him and Doug Ray Scott, they come at each other on motorcycles and then they both do wheelies at the same time because they're totally men and wheelies are what men do. And then they jump in midair at the same time. They jump and they collide in midair and end up on the beach fighting each other.
Yeah.
Which I should point out, the beach fight is cool.
The beach fight is cool. There's no one on this beach.
No.
Other than them. Yeah. And they don't get up right away, but they get up after 1 second. Like, I feel like if they got up right away or they were down for like a minute, I'd be more satisfied. But it's like, oh, that one. Okay, we're good.
My ribs are healed.
You're so dead. Yeah. Broken ribs and punctured lungs and all that.
But
let's not get into
it. The action scene, I do need to say that it is cool. The fight scene is cool. It's very long and kind of bruising. And I like it. I think it works. There's some stuff like the drop kick that Tom Cruise spins out of or whatever. That's stupid, but in general, it's a good fight scene.
Yeah, and even before
there's nothing revolutionary about it, but it's good.
And even before that, as you said, John Woo is known for action, but not specifically hand-to-hand by any means.
Yeah.
But there is some good hand-to-hand stuff when they're inside right before that that I like.
Yeah, definitely.
When he beats up his main crony and all that kind
of
stuff.
No, Tom Cruise, being stealthy around the compound is cool.
Yeah, yeah. Very cool. Leading up to the motorcycle thing, I hadn't seen number two in a while, but everybody remembers the motorcycle fight. That's just, you know, you can't ever forget such a thing.
Yeah. No, them jumping in midair to attack each other is Mission Impossible 2's Langley.
Yeah, drop. Absolutely. Yeah. And not in a good way for most people. But leading up to that, when Sean Ambrose... Doug Ray's actual name, which we tend to never mention.
I prefer to call him Trevelyan.
Okay. It's not even him.
I know. No, I think it's kind of the
same character.
Yeah,
oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. He's showing up to his little place there and all his cronies and his convoy of like Jeeps and Humvees and stuff. And then right in front, it's the two motorcycles, the two matching motorcycles. And there's only two. And I got so excited. Yeah. I was like, it's only 10 minutes away now. The most ridiculous motorcycle stunt ever.
Oh, God. Good times.
Yeah. Very good times. This movie is over the top.
Yeah.
And crazy.
Yes.
And that's kind of what was that. Sort of a reaction to the reviews of the first one, where it was, this one is all cerebral and mostly slow. There's one action scene at the end, and, you know, this movie's made money, but didn't get amazing reviews, at least not really good reviews.
I don't know that it's a reaction. I think it's just sort of...
the pendulum swinging?
No, that's sort of one thing I like about this series, is that it sort of felt itself out. It's not afraid to change, should it feel that change is necessary. And something I like about the series, and... you know, they tried something different and it didn't work. And we see in Mission Impossible 3 that's a totally different movie that, you know, they didn't stick with it. And I like that. I think it's cool. It's admirable. You know, the second movie isn't very good, but it's entertaining.
Yeah. I liked it a lot more than I thought I would.
Okay.
Even this time.
Fair enough.
Knowing how silly it all was.
There's just so much bad cinematography in this movie. Like,
is that what it is? Oh, yeah. You're always the visual expert. So every movie I try to ask you what's going on here visually and how you feel about it.
It's not even that, like... the standard cinematography is bad. It's like, I think Michael Bay loves this movie.
Okay.
Because it's got a lot of the orange and blue contrasting, particularly on the beach, that Michael Bay would soon use constantly.
Yep.
And also just in general, the action scenes are insane. But yeah, and there's so many fast zooms. And here is an item that we want you to see. Zoom it! And it just drives me crazy. I can't deal with it.
Okay.
It makes me upset and sad.
Okay. And what happens in the end? Ethan die?
No.
Okay.
Good. Nobody dies. Ethan and Tandy walk off happily ever after.
Yep.
Yeah. One of them walks into Mission Impossible 3 6 years later.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, a podcast about a four-movie series went so long that we've split it into two parts. So be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about Mission Impossible 3, Mission Impossible 4, and the series as a whole. Until then, you can follow us on Twitter at The MacGuffin Men. You can send us an email, themacguffinmen@gmail.com. If you've got any podcast ideas or anything like that or a question, we answer eventually, I promise. Just check out the website, themacguffinmen.com. This week we wrote a little something about Brad Pitt and the Super Bowl. And next Tuesday, I believe, there will be something probably about Kelly Clarkson. So, yeah, check it out. If not, come back next week. See you then.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. This episode has been brought to you by the Van Halen Comeback. This makes me want to jump off a fucking bridge. Or wait, it makes me want to move to Panama, but then still jump off a bridge. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.